As always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Venezuela's president says the world must again condemn the U.S. for the 2020 assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, who was combating terrorism. South Africa is mourning the death of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, hailed as an icon in the African country's struggle against apartheid. And more than 7,000 flights worldwide are canceled in a single day over Omicron fears and staff shortages. Greetings, everyone. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says the world must raise its voice again in condemnation of the 2020 assassination of top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. Maduro said in an interview that the assassination was a horrific crime. He said Soleimani was, quote, a hero of the struggle against terrorism. General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike at Baghdad airport in January 2020. Iran and Iraq have pledged to take all the legal measures possible to bring the perpetrators and orchestrators of the terrorist attack to justice. The Israeli regime approves a plan to double its settler population in the occupied Golan Heights.
Friends, this is our moment. This is the moment for the Golan Heights. A combination of circumstances has led us to take today a dramatic government decision to channel considerable resources, around $300 million, to strengthen communities in the Golan Heights. After many static years regarding the scope of community life, our goal today is to double the population of the Golan Heights.
Prime Minister Naftali Bennett unveiled the plan earlier on Sunday during a weekly cabinet meeting. Around 25,000 Israelis are currently living in the occupied Golan Heights. Israel annexed the territory in December of 1981, a move never recognized by the international community. Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights and demanded an end to Israel's occupation of the area. 2021 was the year of Palestinian solidarity and unity in the face of continued Israeli aggression and occupation. During the year, Israeli authorities systematically repressed and discriminated against Palestinians in ways that far exceeded the justifications they often provided. Following report details major developments that made headlines over the past year.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6 when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish, or seized multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the Strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians. The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
The Yemeni army announces new military achievements against the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries fighting inside Yemen. The army spokesman says they have seized over 1,200 square kilometers in the northern Adjauf province from Saudi-backed forces. Yahya Sari says the army is almost in full control of the province. He says the Yemeni army will respond to attacks with attacks and will carry out special operations to defend the country. Saudi-led coalition has been at war with Yemen for nearly 7 years now, bombing the country and keeping in place an all-out blockade. In recent weeks, the coalition has intensified its airstrikes with the latest attacks targeting the provinces of Sana'a, Ma'arib, Jawf, Taiz, and Hodeidah. Warplanes bombed these areas over 24 times. Earlier, we were joined by our Sana'a correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, who gave us the latest on the Yemeni army's new gains in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries.
The Al-Jawf province has a strategic importance. I'm going to talk about the importance of Al-Yatama area, which was liberated by the Yemeni army. 1,200 square kilometers were liberated. The Yemeni army managed to take control of these areas. This area is the center of Khab and Ash-Sha'f district, which is the most important district in Al-Jawf, as it has for the largest space of the area, and also it is an oil-rich district, and Saudi Arabia wants to maintain its control over that area to extract the oil from the land. And what is also so important for the Yemeni army is that area is located in the south of Saudi Arabia, and the kingdom has attempted to use this area as a key to launch operations against the Yemeni army to take control of Amran and Saada provinces, which are controlled by the Yemeni army, but they failed to use this area, which is Al-Yatama and Khab and Ash-Sha'f district. It is also very important for the Yemeni army to take control of that area, as the Yemeni army is now controlling all over Al-Jawf except small areas.
South Africa is mourning the death of anti-apartheid icon Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who has passed away at the age of 19. Groups of mourners gathered outside his former parish, St. George Cathedral in Cape Town, to pay tribute to their national hero. A number of memorial services have been organized for the next few days across the country. An official state funeral will be held on January the 1st in the capital. His death on Sunday sparked tributes from world leaders. UN Chief Antonio Guterres hailed Tutu as an inspiration to generations worldwide and an unwavering voice for the voiceless. Pope Francis sent his condolences, hailing his peace-building efforts. Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his campaign against the country's previous brutal system. The outbreak of the new variant of the coronavirus is casting a shadow on the Christmas holidays and affecting millions of travelers. On Sunday alone, over 7,000 flights worldwide were canceled over Omicron fears and staff shortages. Chinese airlines accounted for most of those scrapped flights. Stormy weather conditions are making matters even worse for U.S. airports that saw more than 1,300 flights canceled and 8,500 others delayed. It's been the third day that the fast-spreading Omicron variant has been disrupting holiday travel. Tensions, sanctions, and threats to take more actions were the main features of U.S. foreign policy in 2021. Incumbent President Joe Biden was expected to take a less tense approach towards world affairs than his predecessor Donald Trump, but as you'll see in this next report, disputes persisted and even intensified on multiple fronts.
Joseph Robinette Biden Jr.
President Joe Biden, a Democrat, took over the White House from his Republican predecessor Donald Trump in January 2021. There were expectations that American foreign policy would see less tensions with allies and adversaries under Biden. But that didn't happen. And at times, tensions grew further, like those with China. In fact, the rivalry with China shaped a great portion of Biden's foreign policy as he sought to counter Beijing's growing influence in the world. As a result, disputes such as those on Taiwan, trade, and technology escalated. President Biden even angered his European allies when in September he announced an alliance with Britain and Australia meant to help Canberra build nuclear-powered submarines in the Pacific. The U.S. drew a Pacific ally closer to meet the China challenge, but at the cost of a 2016 deal being scrapped between France and Australia. Furious France called the deal a betrayal that had been secretly negotiated for months. The U.S. move further increased the push within the EU that the bloc needs its own independent military force, with member states aiming to agree on that in March 2022. To counter Beijing, Washington also put more focus on Africa, pledging to boost development in the continent where China already made investment and concluded trade agreements. The U.S. remained at odds with another power in the East, Russia. In addition to several rounds of sanctions over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Washington sparred with Moscow over Ukraine, too. It accused Moscow of preparing a war on its neighbor, ignoring repeated calls by Russia to stay away from near its borders. Cuba and Venezuela were targeted, too. Sanctions against the two Latin American countries remained in place and even intensified over their internal policies. Iran was not an exception either. While it was trying to resolve issues surrounding the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iranian deal. But allies in West Asia had a different place in the U.S.'s foreign policy. Political and military support for Israel continued, despite the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. And American ties with Saudi Arabia were warm, despite Biden's election promise to punish the kingdom for the 2019 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Biden had also pledged to help end the Saudi-led war on Yemen, but despite that, he continued to approve weapons sales to the Saudi government, making the conflict drag on and resulting in more atrocities and war crimes. On Syria, the U.S. pursued this policy, keeping forces there on what Washington called an advisory mission to support Kurdish fighters battling the Daesh terror group. However, the American forces and their military bases came under attack on various occasions. The attacks happened amid calls for the U.S. expulsion from Syria, mainly over civilian casualties caused by American operations. Similar calls also grew in neighboring Iraq, where the U.S. finally ended its combat mission and delimited it to an advisory one. And in Afghanistan, the U.S. implemented President Biden's so-called policy of ending forever wars. America fully withdrew from Afghanistan in August, following a sweeping takeover by the Taliban, the same group Washington toppled when it invaded the country 20 years ago. Biden defended his decision to end the Afghan war as he faced widespread criticism at home and abroad over the pullout marked with chaos and deadly violence. He also remained adamant to unblock frozen assets for Afghanistan under its new rulers, leaving that country alone to deal with all the ruins left behind from the longest overseas war in U.S. history.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
in the limelight.
A leaked report that shows the U.S. military knew for years about dangers to civilian areas follows disclosures of toxic PFAS contamination hidden from the Senate. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Mitchell Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Military Hit Fuel Pipeline Floods from Public in Okinawa. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Lack of accountability has long angered Okinawans who, for decades, have campaigned for an overhaul of the Japan-U.S. Status of Forces Agreement, which allows the U.S. military to operate outside Japanese laws. Under SOFA, the U.S. military completely controls access to its 78 facilities in Japan, 31 of which are in Okinawa Prefecture, and only rarely does it grant access to Japanese authorities. On-duty service members are exempt from prosecution for damage to Japanese property, and the military is not required to remediate contamination on land returned to civilian usage. Because of SOFA, the U.S. military can evade responsibility for such problems. It can hide environmental damage because there is no mechanism to force the U.S. military to open up the information or tell the Japanese government, said Manabu Sato, a professor of political science at Okinawa International University, Ginowan City. Compounding the issue is Japan's long-standing tendency not to take seriously Okinawans' grievances about being forced to host so many military facilities, he said. Is just the latest in a long series of similar incidents. In recent years, environmental infractions committed by the U.S. military on Okinawa include radioactive contamination from depleted uranium, massive spills of fuel, and the discovery of 108 barrels of dioxin-tainted herbicides buried beneath a children's soccer pitch. The military often hides these problems. Many have only been made public via requests filed under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act. The most extensive contamination comes from PFAS chemicals contained in firefighting foams. Near Defense Department's facilities on Okinawa, farmers' fields, natural springs, and rivers are polluted. And the substances have contaminated the drinking water sources of 450,000 residents. Such contamination is pervasive in the United States too, but unlike at home, where the federal government has begun to compel the Defense Department to implement surveys and cleanups, on Okinawa, there has been no such push for accountability. One example of the inaction could be the U.S. military's concealment of details of the Okinawa contamination from American elected officials. Recently, emails obtained via FOIA from the U.S. Marine Corps show the military misled a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee about PFAS contamination in the prefecture. In autumn 2018, the office of Senator Jean Shaheen requested information from the military about whether it had identified PFAS contamination on Okinawa, how it was mitigating and remediating the problem, and how it was cooperating with local governments to protect surrounding communities. The military's responses were inaccurate, incomplete, and minimized the severity of the contamination. On October 18, 2018, the military sent an email concerning contamination levels from Marine Corps Air Station Futenma, a major air base in the populous central Okinawan city of Ginawan. It is stated tests were conducted at the fire training pit and two stormwater conveyances at MCAS Futenma. The fire training pit results showed levels for PFOS and PFOA consistent with the historical use of the site for training with AFFF. Concurrent samples taken from stormwater conveyances upstream and downstream from the airfield were below 5 ppt for PFOS and PFOA. The comment implies that contamination from the fire training area is not impacting off-base communities, but it is misleading. The stormwater test sites that registered the very low levels of contamination were located almost a mile from the fire training area, so these numbers did not prove the site was safe. A Marine Corps email dated November 20th of the same year contained a corrected graphic acknowledging the sample sites and the fire training area were not hydrologically connected. It also revealed severe PFOS and PFOA contamination of 28,800 parts per thousand, but whether this information was sent to the senator's office is unclear. The Marine Corps additionally did not disclose that the corrected map indicates that water from the contaminated training site has been flowing toward a local elementary school. When the existence of the map was reported by the Okinawa Times on December 9th, parents of children who attend the school expressed their outrage and demanded that the school grounds be checked for contamination. In 2017, a window frame from a U.S. military helicopter fell onto the same school's grounds while children were taking an outdoor physical education class. Asked a local mother, "Where should our children walk?" She told the Okinawa Times that she was worried about both the sky above the school and the ground beneath it. "Schools have the image of being safe, but that's not true there," she said. Another email obtained via OFA from the Marine Corps includes a summary of the Air Force's reply to Shaheen. It contains misleading statements implying that the Japanese government was allowed to conduct PFAS checks within Kadena Air Base and that Tokyo had concluded the base was not responsible for the contamination of Hijar River, a source of the island's drinking water. Neither is accurate. The emails obtained from the Marine Corps omit information the military possessed at the time of Shaheen's inquiry. Severe PFAS contamination had been detected in groundwater and the fire training area at Kadena Air Base, and natural springs sacred to Okinawans' indigenous religious communities near Marine Corps Air Station Futenma have been polluted with some of the highest levels of PFAS ever detected in Japan since widespread checks began in 2016. The emails also do not address Shaheen's inquiry about the military's cooperation with local governments. Since 2016, Okinawan authorities have requested access to inspect Kadena Air Base, but such requests have still not been approved. For the past 2 years, the U.S. Air Force has further hindered investigations into PFAS contamination at Kadena Air Base by stalling FOIA requests and refusing to process administrative appeals on the delays. At the time of publication, Shaheen's office had not responded to requests for comment. U.S. Forces Japan and the U.S. Defense Department did not explain whether They have provided Shaheen's office with updated, accurate information. Sato, the Okinawa International University professor, said, "The military thinks that if they can hide its PFAS contamination from the Senate Armed Services Committee, then they will be safe from any investigations. But once the information is revealed, they will be in a very bad position. The government of Japan doesn't want to anger the U.S. It wants to please them in any way. Tokyo has been ignoring these environmental problems for a long time, but as long as they occur in Okinawa, it dismisses them as only Okinawa issues and doesn't raise any fuss."
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law. And we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of 6 coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, 7 more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. 6 civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, 7 more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, 1 more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the Northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is in force in at least 5 Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. 6 decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. So the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these, were to be targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way, so that insurgents could be neutralized. Howsoever, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharya, this much abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also, please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmar's junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused. Because if there is faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then these sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir, and on the ground level you have a lot of presence, with a big presence of the ultras or the other, insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized, and you know, in that context, not a very normal governance process, the country defunction, and therefore the Kashmiri situation is very unique, and the Indian state is often cited that as one of the main reasons that has you know, enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters or you know, laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of the right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram temple session in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represents the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have an agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslim, like Christian, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims. And this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state. And he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim, but also against the Christian and other religions also. Like amended Citizen Act, cancelling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is